because the 7 years of corn, which were healthy and good, and then there were 7 years of corn, which were very thin. And it grew up after them, and the thin ears of corn and the ill-favored cows, they both devoured the previous one. And Pharaoh woke up, and it was a dream. Right, this was the dream. He tried to have the dream interpreted, and the Medrash says, on the passage that he called all his wise men who were versed in the hieroglyphics of Egypt, and he told them his dream, and no one was able to interpret it. Then the Sarmashkin remembered Yosef and told him that there is a Nar Ivri, there is a small, a lad there. They interpreted our dreams, and it seems that he was successful. So it says Pharaoh in sentence 14 called Yosef. By Ritzu, they hurried him up Minapor. By Galach, by Chalef Simlesa, he went ahead, he shaved, and he changed his clothes, and he came to Pharaoh. Before we go into the dream of Pharaoh, this sentence itself is worth mentioning. My Rebbe Zochanei Brachah always mentioned this sentence, and Hirsch, I think, points out the same idea. They treated Yosef the way he described him in sentence 12, like a small Hebrew boy, a servant, an Eved. So he must have some magical powers with him. So let's try him. So Pharaoh went ahead. He wasn't really concerned with Yosef as a person. He just wanted to get him in there quickly and be able to hear what has to do with the dream. So it says, Vayishlach Paro, Vayikra es Yosef, Vayritzu. They hurried him out of the dungeon. But Yosef had a certain dignity to him, a certain royalty to him. So he wouldn't walk in with his prisoner clothes into the presence of the king. Pharaoh wouldn't care less because they didn't care about Yosef as a person. They just wanted to know and to use this God-given gift that he had. But the passage says no. He didn't walk, he didn't run. By Galach, Bechalev, Simlesov, he first shaved himself and he put on proper clothes. By Yobo El Paro, and he walked into Pharaoh. So it showed that Yosef had this dignity, this royalty to him. They just wanted to hurry him along, by Yitzu Minapor, but then he stopped, like, by Galach, by Chalev, Simlesov, by Yobo El Paro. He went ahead and he prepared himself properly, and then he walked into Pharaoh. He wasn't just some urchin, a street boy that they threw into prison, they were going to take him out. He had a certain dignity and royalty that he carried with him. Now getting back to Pharaoh's dreams, you know, the Medrash brings down that all of these people who interpreted the dreams, they made mistakes, and they said that Pharaoh will have 7 daughters, and it'll be, you know, it has to do with his personal family, and Pharaoh would not really accept this, because he felt that this dream was a dream that had something to do with the king, and it had nothing to do with his personal life. And therefore, it couldn't. What shakas? What connection does it have to his daughters that will have daughters, or they'll have other things happening to him? It must have something to do with the fact that he was a king. And Hirsch, as he goes through the dreams, emphasizes some important points. For example, in sentence 1, if you follow in 41:1, it says there, "Vehineh omed al hayor." He was standing. The word al sometimes means on, but obviously you don't stand on a river. So al also means near. He was standing near the river. So this is a very important point. Yet when Pharaoh tells the dream over to Yosef, so he told the dream a little bit differently. He says, "Hineni omed," if you look in sentence 17. When Pharaoh relates this first point, he says, "Hineni omeid al svas hayor." I am standing by the shore of the river. Svas means like by the shore, by the sand of the river, by the beach of the river. Now, there's a very, you say, well, what's the difference? But actually, there is a big difference, Hirsch points out. And the fact that he told them, svas hayor, he told the interpreters, Egyptians, that it was standing al svas hayor, that may have misled them. Because al hayor means on the river. The river, what does it mean standing near the river? because he was considering the river, because the river was the whole lifeline of Egypt. And therefore, standing ala yor means the dream had something to do with the river. Whereas, if you'll give an example, hineni omed al svasa yor, so they'll say, well, it was only there for scenery. I mean, it has nothing to do with the river. He happened to be standing al svasa yor by the beach. But that's when the dream appeared. But not that it had something essentially to do with the river. And over here, it had to do with the river because the river was what he was thinking about. Because the Nile, on the overflowing of the Nile, the whole fertility of Egypt was dependent. So that itself was a very important point. Now, Yosef understood that he meant Alayor because he had God's wisdom at this moment. God helped him. But if you would have just a plain hieroglyphics expert, or like he says, one who interpreted dreams or magic or so on, he would have to listen to the dream, and Eimed al Svasa Yor would be a very misleading landmark. The second thing it says, if we go on, in sentence two, it says, and from the river came up seven calves. Now how does he describe the calves? Yefos Mareh Ubrios Vosor, meaning they were well favored, they looked healthy, and they were also Ubrios, heavy and healthy in flesh. Now, this is the way one would describe a healthy cow. Now, if you'll look at sentence 18, we'll go sentence by sentence, and 18, when he tells Yosef about the dream, he describes the cows a little bit different. He says, Brios Bosser, that's fine. Brios Bosser is the same, but he says, Yefos Toa, beautiful in form. Now, he says, beautiful in form, that's not, doesn't have anything to do with a butcher. That has to do with a painter, that has to do with an artist, something which is beautiful in form. There's a big difference. Yefos Mareh, which really, Yefos Mareh, which appeared to Pharaoh, they were good to look at. That's true, you see a cow, it's good to look at, it's healthy of flesh. But you're not going to go and say it had very nice aesthetics, it was beautiful in form. What does that have to do with a cow? You're going to eat the cow. You're not going to hang it on the wall as a picture. So the fact that when Pharaoh described this in sentence 18, he said, your face doah, so they could already said, well, maybe it has to do with provinces, with daughters, and so on. It has nothing to do with eating, because your face doah means an appearance, not your face mara. So that makes a big difference. Now, the same thing that he says, the tamodna, if you look at the end of sentence 3, the Tamodna, they stood, Eitzel HaToros al Svas HaYor. It says the seven other cows that came out, they came out, and they didn't look too good. They were rose Mareh. They looked pretty bad. Again, he uses the expression of Mareh, which he used in sentence two, that they were very bad in form and lean flesh. But he adds, the Tamodna, they placed themselves, Eitzel HaToros, by the other cows, or Svasa Yor, meaning the, here Svasa Yor came in, because it's saying the other cows, the lean cows, were standing al Svasa Yor. When the good cows came out with the blessing, you then had the lean cow standing on the side. Now when Pharaoh relates this in sentence 19, he doesn't say anything about the lean cows standing on the side. He just says in sentence 19, these ugly cows came out, and he was impressed by their ugliness, says, I had never seen such ugly cows. And then he says they ate up the other, but he doesn't say they were standing there. Now that's an important point about they were standing there. What does that mean? Well, the way Hirsch says that bad cows are not cannibals by nature. Hunger would not have made them eat up the others had these left them over food in the meadow. That means if there would have been food for them, then they wouldn't have devoured the other cows because they're not cannibals. So the warning lies in the dream. That means the dream told you something, not to eat up everything in the years of plenty. They're standing there, leave something for them coming out of the water, like to feed them. They will only eat the cows if there is nothing to feed them. Meaning you would only totally destroy Egypt or eat up whatever they were healthy if there's no food left for them. So this gave Yosef some insight. Yet, He didn't tell them that. He told them what it said in sentence 18. So that also was lacking a little bit, some interpretation. And if it wouldn't have been that God had given Yosef this wisdom, there is no way that he would have been able to go ahead and to interpret this phrase. So it's extremely important, the difference in the description, between both of these, because the story is told, when a person sees a story, Pharaoh told the story the way he sees it. History, as we always say, is different. God gives you the facts, but it's subjective to the person's interpretation and understanding. Yosef was, with his prophecy, was privileged to see the dream the way it was given to Pharaoh. The others didn't have this. They heard the dream the way Pharaoh related it to them, and when he related it to them, he let out these crucial points, the three things that were emphasizing the fact that originally the cows were coming out of the water, the healthy cows, he left that out, and the fact that he described these cows as if they were aesthetically beautiful, something to do with appearance and form of painting, like a painter would paint, not something that a butcher would be interested in. And he also, instead of Mara, he put Toar, and also he didn't say that the weak or sick cows were standing on the side waiting to come out. That was a very important point that he had left out. And therefore Yosef was blessed with the wisdom, but the others were lacking. Now, when Yosef goes ahead and he gives Pharaoh the interpretation for this dream, we see that he tells Pharaoh, after he interprets this dream, and saying the reason why it happened, he dreamt this twice, it means it's going to happen very soon. But some of the commentaries point out, although Yosef had also last week had two dreams about the brethren coming to visit him and acknowledge him, and there were two dreams, yet we see that years and years went by. So they point out, or as Rashbam points out, the difference being that Yosef's dreams were not on the same night. But over here, it was in the same night, one dream right after another. So the fact that they both appeared in the same night sort of emphasized that it's going to happen shortly. And therefore, he says in sentence 32, regarding the fact that this was shown to Pharaoh twice, so that means that it's prepared and it's about to happen. So you have to react. How should you react? He says, let Pharaoh look for a man who is wise by Shiseyu al Eretz Mitzrayim. The word Shiseyu, to place him, does not mean like appoint him. It means to give him a free reign, that he should be not just another appointee, but he should be an independent person working on his own. And then he continues in sentence 34, that Pharaoh should go ahead and appoint pekidim. Pekidim means officers who will take a tax of 20%. Now the 20% tax was usually double than they would take it. At most they would take 10%. Here they're taking 20% of all the grain that grows in the 7 years. Now Yosef was very astute. If you notice, he used the language in 34. He didn't say that this person that you appoint will go ahead and collect the tax. No, you're going to appoint the person to control Egypt. Now the tax, that has nothing to do with him, because this person has to gain the love and the favor of everybody in order to be able to implement this plan. If he's going to be a tax collector, there's nothing doing. I mean, everybody loves Congress when they give out money. So there'll be great bounty. So people will do, they'll go ahead and they'll sell to the neighboring countries, and they'll gather in all the money. So what will that do them good? Money is good if you have what to buy, but when you don't have what to buy, there's no money. So therefore he says that no longer will they be able to go ahead and deal with outside forces and grain. Not only that, each city, it says, Echol Be'orim B'Shemoru. One city is not permitted to deal with another city in grain. If they have excess grain, we will store, Pharaoh, the government will buy the grain from them and store the grain in the individual cities. And therefore the people, when the hunger becomes, so they won't go frantic, because they'll know that there is grain available, because they will see the storage for grain. And they wouldn't have exported this, so there would be plenty food there for everyone. This was understanding. This was in 36. He says, and the food will be l'pikodon l'eret, l'sikoris oret perov, and the land will not die in hunger. Now, in 37, Pharaoh loved this, because probably this is very logical. You understand the idea of raising taxes double, which not taxes money, but taxes food. So the people will not squander that much. They'll know that they don't have that much left. In addition, they will not go ahead and export it. The king will buy it, and they'll say, oh, the king is taking this, and he's going to sell it himself and make a fortune of money. No, it's going to be in every community. They will have storage places, so they will feel that the food is at hand. So probably such sable was something new to Pharaoh. Where did he ever had that? So it says, Vayita v'adover v'ein ephara. This was agreeable in the eyes of Pharaoh. The only one thing that the commentaries are troubled a little bit with, wasn't he a little bit too forward? What did Pharaoh ask him? He didn't ask him how to run the country. He just asked him, what's the interpretation? So what gave Yosef the license to go ahead and solve the solution? Tell him what the dream is and let Pharaoh go ahead and give the solution. But the truth is that the dream itself provided in a bit the solution. The fact that he had the seven lean years standing by the seven full years meant that there was a way that they would be able to provide from the seven full years for the seven lean years. It wasn't just that there will be seven full years and then seven lean years. But if you remember the dream itself, he omitted that, Pharaoh, about the lean cows standing next to the full cows. But that was the dream. So that dream gave him the license or the opportunity to explain how seven full years can feed seven lean years, that they won't have to become like cannibals. That means if you tax them and you go ahead and that's the way the seven full years can lean. At least the dream alluded to that. So he had the proper license to be able to insert his interpretation. Now, they went ahead and they appointed Yosef. Now, if you notice in sentence 38, before they appointed Yosef, it seems that Pharaoh had to get permission. Not that he had to get permission, but he had to get the consensus, although he was an absolute ruler. But he said to his servants, Anim so kezeh ish asher ruach alekimbo, is there another person as good as him, like, who possesses within him the Spirit of God? Now, why did he say that? The reason why he said that was because the Jews were looked down upon in Egypt. Yet, it seems that even if they're looked down upon, but they had this wisdom. You don't have to invite them to eat with you, which they didn't, but here is somebody who has wisdom in economics, and he has the ability. Now, actually, that's something that wasn't only in Egypt. You know, I think it happens behind the boardrooms of many great industries and countries. It also, I mean, the Jew is still the Jew, but he happens to have a cup, so we have to go ahead and we have to use him. So Pharaoh told the people, don't get uptight because I'm going ahead and I'm taking a Hebrew and appointing him, because in Egypt we see that nobody has this gift, this Ruach HaLakim, which he calls his gift. And this person has the solution to this problem, which it was a tremendous solution. It seems it's interesting because in economics, you usually have a lot of Jewish people in that field. Even today, the heads of the federal agency is really basically was Greenspan, and before him was Walker. I mean, these are all people that Jewish background. So now, this is what happened. So there were two more events here. Now, Pharaoh had to take this Hebrew boy, and you just can't appoint him. You had to give him tremendous power that he should be recognized by the people. So he says in sentence 40, the only thing that will be greater than you, he gave him this, this appointment that only the throne will be greater than you. And then that's what he said to him. And then he says in 41, see, I have appointed you in the land of Egypt. What is this? See, what is this extra sentence? But actually, it says in 42, he took off the ring. This was the act, like giving somebody the yoke. Taking off the ring was the act of elevating Yosef to this position. So in sentence 41, he says to him, see, like he's anointing him or elevating him to position by placing the ring upon him, and he gave him this ring. And then we find that they gave him a name, Sofnas Panea, in sentence 45. There's discussion what the meaning of that name is, Sofnas Panea. Some say it means that he, Sofn is the word hidden. And Panea, we could say that, which he wanted, some commentators are troubled with that, but Rashi, the Hirsch wants to interpret that, that he whom the most secret things are kept. So Tzofnas Baneach means he holds the key to the hidden secrets. That's the name that they gave him at that time. And he also gave him Osnas Bas Potiphera. Now here there's some interesting midrashim. Who was this wife? Osnas, the daughter of Potiphera, Kohen Om Leisho. Now, this Osnas Bas Potiphera, some say it was the daughter of his previous mistress of the household. That means that that was the wife of the of Potiphar, Sarah of Sarah. Therefore, some want to say in the Russian that that's why she tried to deceive, because she saw through her gazing that there would be some relationship, a family relationship between Yosef and her, but she didn't understand it was the cloud, a little cloudy also, the crystal ball, sometimes it's a little snowy. Didn't see clear, and it turned out Osnas, her daughter, now if Osnas was really her daughter, or Osnas was an adopted child, that also there's a beautiful medrash that says that Osnas was the daughter of Dinah. And when she went, ended up in Egypt, now the only difficulty in that medrash is why they didn't keep her in the house. But when she ended up in Egypt, the one thing he gave her was a kameya. Kameya meaning the amulet that they wore around like a necklace. And then people were throwing things at Yosef when he went by. And then it said there, Basia, from Yaakov's family. And he saw this kameya, and then he traced it to Osnas. That's a medrash. But it's very important, as soon as Yosef was appointed, Hirsch points out here, as soon as Yosef was appointed to this position, the first thing that he had to do was to be married. Because a person who was like a bachelor couldn't belong in the White House, as they used to say. That means a person who leads a nation is more responsible, or the people have more trust in him. Especially, let me quote just from Hirsch, he says, he would have the most beneficial influence if he, the first in the land after Pharaoh, set the example of simple living in his house and family life. That means he would show them how to live. But for that, a wife and a family were necessary. A single man without a wife and family is not felt to be so intimately together with the general public in times of stress and worry. But with wife and children, he participates in the general trouble of the people. Which is true. In fact, we find in Halacha, Yom Neroim, it says when you think like a chazan, you should pick a person who has a family, because then he feels stronger when he begs Hashem for mercy and compassion. He feels stronger the idea of racham. Later, I don't know if we'll get to it, but it was a tremendous, I never noticed it before. We'll deviate for a moment with the word racham, where Hirsch says the word racham means. This is from chapter 43, but when Yaakov later speaks to the sons, when they finally go back, he says to Yosef the second time of the story, when they had trouble with him, when they'll finally go back and take Binyamin, he had no choice. So there, Yaakov uses the word Kel Shaddai, Yiten Lachem Racham. The God of strength, Shaddai, should give you racham. Now we always touch racham, with Neolish, that means you should find sympathy. We always find Rachmanis, sympathy, and so on. But he says the word Rachamim is a little bit more than that, more than mercy. Rachamim designates, he says, that sympathy of God, which is most general and unusable, and which is a fundamental trait which characterizes the relationship of his creatures one with another. Rachamim is said as family love, basically, and it comes from the little word rachem. Rachem is a womb. So actually, rachamim, meaning from the womb, the family togetherness, the love of children, the love of parents to children, children to parents, the love of children to one another, on account of the common rachem out of which they come. Now he says, perhaps people are inclined to mix up rachamim with rachmonis and to take it to mean pity. He says, no, rachmonis is one thing, rachamim is another. Because he says, pity is a far lower feeling beneath that which true rachamim means. And this is beautiful. He says, which is rarer? Which ennobles man more? To be moved to pity at others' sorrow, or to be moved to joy at their happiness? He says, there are very few people who do not feel sympathy with the suffering of their fellow men. But it is not everybody who feels sympathy with a poor man today and feels joy to a similar degree if he draws the first prize in the lottery overnight and tomorrow he sees him passing the street riding with his family as he puts in a Rolls Royce. You don't feel anything. You may feel a little jealous, but that's Rachmonis. When he's down and out, you have pity. He says, Rachamim, the feeling that we are to have heritage means more than pity. It comes from Rachem, from the womb. And in there, he says, afterwards too, when the new being is the child, for example, afterwards, when the new being is there, the Rachem begets not only sympathy with its crying, but even more intimate joy with its smiling. The smile from the baby and the laugh makes up for years of worry and sleepless nights. From this Rachem is Rachamim formed, and not only suffers when the other suffers, but knows no rest until he sees him happy. So the word Rachamim, he says, is different than Rachmonis. It's a more intimate relationship. He says, when God gives you Rachamim, meaning you're not just asking God for compassion, you're asking God for this close relationship of a father, of a parent, concerned really for his son, for his child, his family relationship. And therefore, we hope that God will also smile at you with your success. Not only will God, you know, be concerned and pity with you, but he will also smile at your success. It's an interesting concept. And back to what we were speaking about, Yosef, the first thing he does was to go ahead and he marries the daughter of this Kohen On, who some would say, as we said, that he was his previous master. And then he has children. Seven, sentence 50. Also, the way he writes it in sentence 50 is interesting. If you look at sentence 50, it says, well, Yosef, you Lord, Shnei Bonim, and to Yosef, two sons were born before the years of famine came, which Osnas, the daughter of Potipharah, bare unto him. Now, again, he says, it seems that it's superfluous, it's redundant, that you just say that two children were born unto him by Esnas Bas Potipharah. Why does it say, well, Yosef, and to Yosef, two sons were born, and then it repeats again that the daughter had born unto him. So he wants to say that this itself shows you, in ordinary circumstances, he says, it suffices to say that the wife bears to her husband two children that grows up under their combined influence. But in the case here in Egypt, remember, the mother was the daughter of a priestly family, and Yosef was only a slave, and he was a Hebrew. So now, who are these children going to grow up like? One would think that the influence that Yosef would have wouldn't be too much going into a family like that. It would be the same influence like we find sometimes that a Jew finally made it and he marries one of the Kennedys. I mean, that child is not going to be a Strasburg, whatever the name is. It's probably going to be a Kennedy. The idea is because you're going against, you're bucking a whole environment and you're bucking a whole power. What are you? So here also, Yosef, I mean, what was he? He was appointed to this position. He had no family with him. He was an Ar-Ibri. And here he's taking from the daughter of the Tayanayin. So did you really say that they're going to be Yosef's children? So therefore, attributing, I mean, in this way, praising Osnas, so it shows you that, no, the Torah writes, Yosef, you Lord, Shnei Bonim. that these were truly children that can be called the sons of Yosef. And this is the greatness, he says, to be the only Jew in Egypt, quote, to have the daughter of the priest of an idolatrous cult for a wife, and still to have children and bring them up, that to this very day, parents bless their children, to Ephraim and to Menashe. That means that would be the greatest merit, so therefore that has to be stressed. That Yosef, even under such circumstances, Yulach Neponi. Of course, it shows the greatness of Yosef, but it also shows that his wife was recognized that and lived in that type of a situation as Yosef. Now, he named his two sons Ephraim and Menashe. This is one thing that bothers many people. What is the meaning of Menashe? It says here that Yosef called the name of his firstborn son Menashe. Kinashani Elikim. Now, normally, Nashani is interpreted there, God has helped me or made me forget. As base Avi, as Kol Amoli, all my troubles, as Kol Beis Avi, my father's house. Now, this would be very difficult. Yosef is calling his child, thanking God for helping him forget his father's house. I mean, one would think that he wanted to remember Yaakov. In fact, that was the whole idea. So how can you go ahead and say, call a child Menashe? Because Nishani Elikim, he wanted me to forget my father's house. But this really brings us up to a different question. I mean, it's worth noting. Gersh interprets Nishani differently. We'll get back to that. But the question here is, why did he indeed forget his father's house? Because when you go back in the next reference and sentence, we'll look on in the next chapter, in sentence 11, it says there, or in sentence 9, in chapter 42, speaking there that the brothers come to Yosef. So it says, Vayaker Yosef Esaf, even 8, that he recognized them. And then in sentence 9 it says, Vayiskor Yosef. Yosef remembered the dreams that he had dreamt. Now, on this point, the Ramban stops on this point, that Yosef remembered the dreams that he had dreamt. Now, what does this mean? So Ramban says that, first he quotes Rashi. And Rashi says, well, now he knew that his dream was fulfilled because the brothers bowed down to him. Ramban explains the other way around, that when Yosef saw the brothers bowing down to him, he says it would make more sense to remember the dreams that they have not been fulfilled yet. Because the dream was that all the brothers would bow down in the first dream. Your stocks bowed down to mine. And then he had the dream, after all the brothers, he had another dream, the star, the moon, and the sun, the stars. Now that really wasn't even touched yet. So how could Rashi say, remember the dreams? So the Ramban says the following, that since what it means that he remembered the dreams that they had not come about yet. Once he saw that Binyamin was not there, so then he had to get Binyamin to come. Why? Because otherwise the dream would not be fulfilled. Therefore he didn't want to say immediately Ani Yosef. Because if he would say Ani Yosef, the dream would not come about. Because his father would immediately come, and the first dream wasn't fulfilled yet. So after the first dream was fulfilled, so then he told them that in order to fulfill the second. So this is the way the Ramban says, that the whole idea here was to get these dreams to be fulfilled. Therefore he masqueraded himself. But then the Ramban continues, and he says, and if this would not be the rationalization, then Yosef would have been a tremendous sinner. Why? Because he was Mitzayer Esaviv. He knew the father was how far away he could have sent the father a message for 20-some years. He let the father believe that didn't know what happened to him, and then he was mourning for Shimon also, and he just ignored the father, even if he wanted to make the brothers suffer. But he had an old father. So why did he act this way the whole time? So he says, but he did it with a purpose, in order to bring about the fulfillment of the dreams. And also the idea, he says, of placing the cup in their sack, Also, he didn't just want to be Messiah there, but he wanted to prove that maybe they will have something against Binyamin. He wanted to see if Binyamin, maybe, you know, if he wanted them to come back with Binyamin, and therefore he wanted to prove if they have a sin, a hatred against Binyamin, because he was Rachel's son, the same way that they had the sin against him. So that's why he did the second part. And then the Ramban says, and you have to say all of this, that it's because of the dream, because otherwise, since he was already, he was an appointment at the beginning, he was the administrator of a great household for this Tsar, how didn't he write one letter to his father? Ki Mitzrayim Korev Lechevren, it was only 6 days away. And even if it was a year, he said. So therefore you have to say it was that the dream should come about. So he didn't forget his father's household. He remembered it. In fact, he was living it through because he wanted the dreams to come about. Now on this Ramban, Hirsch stops and he disagrees with it very strongly. He starts out, he says, we must try to explain Yosef's behavior. We should have thought that for his father's sake he would have made himself immediately known to them immediately, especially as he already recognized God's hands, right? And what will you say? A clever man like Yosef would also not think that he had to fulfill all the details of the dreams. It wasn't a command from God. He just had dreams. If a dream has any meaning, then you could leave its realization to God. You don't have to act out your dream if it would be a command through a prophet. So God told him to do this, he would have to do this. But it wasn't a command through a prophet, he just had two dreams. So if the dream will come about, it'll come about. If it won't come about, it won't. You don't have to act out. In fact, to do such a thing, not to let a father suffer for so many years, just so I should act out a dream that came to me, that's unheard of, he said. It could only be the contrary, he says, that considerations of necessity caused him to adopt this behavior. Now, what did he mean here? He had two things that he wanted to prove himself. That he himself can have a different opinion of his brothers by seeing, you know, how the brothers react with Binyamin and with him, and also that his brothers have a different opinion and felt differently towards him. Their inner feelings towards one another must have become different to what they formerly were. So this was really a test. That's why he tried to see it, because if he would have told his father, and this would have never come out in the open, they wouldn't have acted out their feelings, then there would never have been the unity amongst the children of Yaakov Avinu. So this is, I just took briefly, this is what Hirsch goes into in great detail. So there's a basic difference from the Ramban and from Hirsch. According to the Ramban, all of this was because he had to bring about the fulfillment of his dream. And according to Hirsch, no such thing. But it was necessary to reunite the house of Yaakov. But according to both of these interpretations, it's clear that if anything was on his mind, it was the fact that he had a father, and that he had brothers, and that he wanted to reunite, not that he had made him forget his, like it says here in 41, that Yosef called his oldest son Menashe because God had made him forget all that happened to him and his father's household. That was the furthest thing from him to forget his father's household. So Hirsch interprets the word nishani not as forget, but the word nishani, the root, can also come from nosha, meaning to be a creditor. Nosha means that you owe something. So here he was saying, ki nashani elikim, God has made me indebted to kol amoli v'eskol beisavi, to everything that occurred to me. Really, it was all for my benefit. It was all for my purpose. And therefore, God has made me indebted to all the happenings that happened to now, because if it wouldn't have happened, he would have never achieved this position. So to the contrary, instead of forgetting, I am deeply indebted to my misfortune and my family. It's a difference from Hirsch to the others in the meaning of the word nashami. Literal, everybody interprets it coming from forgetfulness. And he says Nashani is basically dealing with being indebted, but not really forgetting. A famine started, and all the people in Egypt became hungry, and they screamed to Pharaoh for bread. Now, why did they scream for Pharaoh? That would be interesting. Why did they scream to Pharaoh? Why didn't they go to Yosef? It says, Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Yosef. Whatever he will tell you to do, you should do. On this, it's worth bringing down the simple pshat that Rashi says. Rashi quotes the Midrash that Yosef, they had stored. See, they sold to the government and so on, but they also had stored of their own. And everything that they had stored became fafoil, spoiled, except that which Yosef had stored. So what does this mean? So he said, everything that Yosef tells you to do, why did they go to Pharaoh? Because they went to Yosef. So Yosef told them that he wants them to circumcise himself. So they ran to Pharaoh. So he says, we have no choice. I mean, if he has this power that everything got spoiled except this grain, so everything that he tells you, you have to do, because otherwise he could go ahead and, just like he supposedly with his power decreed that the grain should be spoiled, so he'll also decree that you could die, and you'll die. So that's how Rashi quotes the Medrash in this passage. But if you take it literally, of course, the question would only be, why did they go to Pharaoh? Well, you would think that they weren't aware that Yosef had this authority. You know, he was collecting the grain, purchasing the grain, but maybe he didn't have the final authority. So then Yosef, then Pharaoh tells him, which is of interest, Pharaoh says, go to Yosef, whatever he sells, you will do. Now, in its literal sense, it means that Pharaoh really gave Yosef the entire authority. He said only Rak HaKiseh, only the throne. Remember, he said to him when he appointed him, only the throne will be higher than you. He didn't say, well, you could say that's another way of saying it, but to me that had more of an emphasis. He didn't say, not only I will be higher than you. He could have said, only I will be higher. You could say, well, that's how you say the throne. That's how you would think. But maybe it has another implication. That Pharaoh said, even I won't be higher than you. In a sense, I won't interfere at all with your doing. The whole, only one that will be higher than you is the concept, the throne, of that you have to have your allegiance to the land of Egypt, to the throne of Egypt. But I, as a person, will not exert any more power over you. Rak HaKiseh. Only the idea is you're totally autonomous. You only have to have your allegiance, we'll say, to the throne and to Egypt. But in all practical purposes, I won't exert any force at all over you. And therefore here, when they came to Pharaoh, he said, go to Yosef, whatever he will tell you, I'll do. Because Pharaoh gave up all of his authority. Now it says that Yosef, what did he, in sentence 56, it says, Vayiftach Yosef es kol asher bohem, vayizbor lemitzrayim. Yosef opened up all the warehouses. But it says the word vayizbor. Now what is vayizbor? So Hirsch interprets vayizbor as meaning retail, which is also very smart. Sheber meaning a little bit. He didn't go ahead and sell as much grain as he wanted. But if you remember during the Second War, we used to get the ration books, right? We'd add for sugar, what did they ration? I forgot already, sugar. So by Yisbor, meaning that he rationed the Chol Eretz Mitzrayim. He rationed to the people, he would only sell them retail. Because he wanted this to, and then it says in sentence 57, and all countries came to Egypt, Lishbor El Yosef. But even when others came from other countries, he sold them, but not large sums. And when he sold, he wanted the master of the house to come, not to send servants. He wanted to know how many people and each family, and they had a special, because in, a little bit later, it says in sentence 6, 42:6, if you'll notice, it says, Yosef hu ha-shalit, hu ha-mazbir l'chol ha-ma'oretz. Now Yosef was the governor of Egypt, and he was the one who sold in retail to all the people. How could you have a storekeeper, the governor of Egypt, doesn't really make sense. But it seems that when it came to selling, exporting, he was the one who directly it had to go under him. In order that goods should not be exported for other, you know, anything outside. He was the customs chief, he himself. That's why the children came along to the children of Israel, in sentence 5, they had to go directly to Yosef.
Why didn't he send for the father the whole time, the Ramban asked? So he answers to that point that Yosef wanted the dream he brings down to become fulfilled. They asked, that doesn't make sense. He doesn't have to worry, like Hirsch asked, that the dream should become fulfilled. So then another answer was given that it was impossible for him to do anything, because when he was a slave, it was impossible. When he became an insider, he was under scrutiny every moment. It wasn't possible. So that it was just an impossibility. That's what they answered. Others wanted to say, Hirsch and others wanted to say, the reason was that Yosef wanted to see him revealing himself to his father and finding the situation again, a situation so wrought with hatred and acrimony and almost bring to fratricide and so on, is not going to solve anything. It will only give the father worse aggravation, because what will the father see? The father will see that these are hating him and he's hating them, and they went so far and they sold him. Like this, Zolam Cholam, and that what? That Chayaroach, a lawsuit at least. That, you know, he was devoured by a beast, but not that his sons had such a hatred that they could bring this. So Yosef, and this I think is in the point that Hirsch discussed, Yosef wanted to be sure that there is no hatred left between him and his brethren, that they can be really united, that the brothers amongst themselves were united, because he wanted to see that this wasn't a family that was so diffused. And he saw that, because he saw at the end how the brothers stood up and they wouldn't be separated. So he realized that the house of Yaakov could again be complete. Now the idea of, don't forget, they were what we say, playing for bigger stakes. They were playing for the eternity of Klal Yisrael and the future of the world. So they were looking at greater things than personal feelings. And therefore Yosef, he says, had to make sure. That's why when they came to him, he went through this whole charade, he went through the idea of showing himself as a stranger. It wasn't because he wanted to punish them. Every moment that he did something was really for a test. And once he was convinced that indeed the brothers have changed, and he was convinced that deep down in his spirit he has rid himself of all feelings of hatred towards them, then he actually was ready to reveal himself. And this is the way Hirsch explains this. He let it in God's hands. He figured this was something, if Hashem wants it this way, I've learned, Hashem brings this about. And there's no necessity for me to intervene and perhaps go ahead and destroy or in some way place obstacles in God's plan. The same question that they asked in the Ramban would be valid here, because the question in the Ramban was, you don't have to act out your dreams. If God wants the dreams to be, you have to act as your normal way, not what the dreams are. You don't have to act out your dreams. You have to act like what's questioned of a person. So now, if Yosef had to have these feelings, the fact that he wants the dreams to come about, that's not for you. Forget about that. You have to do what you have to do. So in a sense, the same idea would be here. You can't say that this is all part of God's plan because God's going to bring it about and therefore I have to remain silent. That's one way of looking at it, which would be in the way of the Ramban. But the same way that they question the Ramban would really be applicable here too. And this could be a discussion that a person could discuss as to how far you intercede or intervene in God's ways. And we have this all the time in life, you know. I mean, even in Israel, in the events that are happening now in Israel, I mean, we have to conduct ourselves according to understanding, not say that this is Mashiach's times, and therefore we have to go trying to bring about Mashiach, and we don't care what the world says, and we could go ahead and, you know, act in an undiplomatic, irrational way because we're sure that this is the wish of God and so on. Even if we would be sure this is the wish of God, if there would be no commandment to act out of the ordinary or irrationally, we wouldn't have the right to do that. We would have to do it in the normal fashion unless God would go ahead and tell us. We don't, that's basically the idea. I said last week, and it's the same idea, the brothers felt they were 100% right. They told him because he was a mass murderer, potentially in a spiritual genocide. Yet, they finally realized in this Sedra, Ashamim, it says later, where they're bemoaning the fact in chapter 43, they said this sentimental feeling of having a brother, Ashamim Anachnu, the feeling of having a brother cry such bitter tears, and we don't move. We're rocks. We can't be shaken. Similar case you have by Tomar last week. Tomar went ahead and she said she's willing to get thrown into the Kivshino Esh, really, to suffer whatever fate, rather than to shame someone Barabim. The Medrash describes that she went around feeling that she is bearing twins, and she had this spiritual feeling that from there will come the Malchus Yisrael and everything else. So again, she had such lofty, glorying aspirations, and now all she could do to save herself is just to say Yehuda's the guilty one, which really he was. Yet it says, Mutav sheyapil atzmei lekiv shanoesh, throw yourself into the fire, ve'al yalbim pnei chavere barabim, and don't go ahead and shame someone publicly. Again, because this is a human feeling, an emotion, a sentiment, and you don't have to worry about the more grandiose plans. You have to act according to the proper way for a human being.